The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. Is that volume okay? Yeah. Okay. So, I thought today we would explore the quality of metta, or goodwill, or loving kindness, in particular in its role as a parami in the Buddhist teachings. And what that means is that there are a set of, in our tradition, 10 character qualities that are called paramis. And these are said to be qualities that support our walking of the spiritual path, and that these are things that we develop. We're not going to go through all of them, but they include things like ethical conduct, generosity, wisdom, energy, patience, equanimity, and one of them is metta, goodwill. Happens to be the 9th out of 10, actually, somewhat implying its challenge to have to be supported by all the other ones. So we'll talk a little bit about what this quality is and how we can develop it so that it becomes just a part of our character. It's not something that we're doing consciously or something that we're doing because our teacher says we need to develop it, things like that. It just becomes internalized. So metta, this quality, is often translated as loving kindness, although some people react to that word. Goodwill is also nice, or just friendliness can be helpful. It's a universal type of love, if you will, you know, something that often spiritual traditions talk about. It's not one that shows favoritism for partners or friends or relatives only, you know, the people who are close to us or special to us. It's much more broad and open than that. Ajahn Suchito calls it holistic kindness, which I really like that phrase. It's a beautiful quality of the heart. So one aspect of this quality as a parami that I do want to talk about is the fact that it follows the 8th parami, which is basically a strong resolution called adhitana, or resolve. And most of the paramis, you can kind of see how they unfold one to the next. But this particular juncture between strong resolve and loving kindness, I think, is very interesting and worth looking at. There are a number of sort of neat interrelationships that I hope will unfold as we talk about it. So in the case of Buddhism, we talk about metta, this quality of loving kindness, in terms of its key qualities and also in terms of what are called its near and far enemies, so things that are not metta. Essentially, metta is the wish for another being or ourself to be well and happy. And for me, a practical way to touch into it is that metta is pretty close to the feeling that arises when we look up on the street and we see our good friend approaching in the distance. And there's kind of this lifting of the heart. Oh, there's my friend. And, you know, maybe we'll smile or somehow, you know, see them coming toward us and have a response. And there's a feeling of brightening. And so in the cultivation of metta, I like to say that we cultivate it such that that feeling is compatible with the presence of any being. It's kind of a strange way to, maybe a subtle way to say it, but this is implying that there can't be another being in our presence that could take that away from us. We don't have to like every being, but that quality of love should be something that we can still carry no matter who is in our presence or who we're thinking of. And so this is the challenge of developing it, you know, even those difficult people or people we don't know at all, can we still have that feeling? Now, the far enemy of goodwill or loving kindness is, of course, ill will. Far enemy of goodwill is ill will, wishing harm upon another. So it's, you know, it's unlikely maybe that we spend a large part of our day wishing harm upon other people, but, you know, we have our moments where we wish something would happen to slow somebody down or something. Don't feel judgmental if you have this in your heart to some degree, because that would be ill will toward your own ill will. It's very human that we have these feelings. And actually doing formal metta practice can help to change that dynamic of the heart, can purify this, if you will. Maybe more interesting is the near enemy of metta, so something that kind of looks like metta but is not, and that is usually called attachment. So this is an entangled kind of love or friendliness that is bound up with desire, essentially. And it's very common that we have this in our intimate relationships and with our friends, is that, you know, there's a lot of open-heartedness, a lot of beautiful, loving quality, and some attachment, you know, a sense maybe that we want them to do things for us if we do things for them. You know, we expect them to be there for us. We expect certain things from them. So there's that, a little bit of entanglement that gets mixed in. Interestingly, the formal development of metta will also purify our attached love into a freer kind of love that's actually better for both the other person and ourselves. So it's more common in our tradition to talk about metta as one of the Brahma Viharas, if you will. These are the four qualities of heart that are said to be resting places for the mind. The other three are compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So metta, and then metta is the fourth. And then I wouldn't say that metta is fundamentally different as a Brahma Vihara and as a Parami, but there are some things that come out differently when we think of it as a quality of character and not so much, say, as an intention. So as a Brahma Vihara, we cultivate metta through intention, through wishing, and actually a little bit through resolve, adhitana. I'm starting to tie that in. And the idea is to progressively widen the field of who we wish well until it's boundless, essentially. So we start with ourselves and those who are dear to us, and then include neutral beings, difficult beings, until all the barriers have been broken down. This is very beautiful kind of practice. There's just a slight shift, I would say, as a parami. I think metta focuses more on resolving the self-other distinction or division. It's the same effect, we're removing barriers, but the approach is that we're kind of using the wisdom of not self in addition and in a more explicit way. This was how Ajahn Suchito was calling things holistic kindness, so having this sense of the whole and not the parts, not the little individual pieces that are inevitably then going to come into conflict. So we're aiming at breadth, not necessarily intensity in developing this. And it's all about the relationship, really. We're not really standalone beings navigating through a world, although that's a convenient way to think. So we're considering our relationship with other beings and our relationship certainly with ourselves and with maybe even with experience itself. So a few comments on why metta follows from resolve. In one sense, metta is a specific resolve, as I mentioned. So this is a quote from Ajahn Suchito. When we make the resolution of kindness, not just toward kittens on a nice day, but even toward cockroaches on a bad day, when we include dictators and brutal maniacs, as well as all aspects of ourselves, then we're making metta into a perfection, a vast and transfiguring way of life. The result is a mind that is grounded in wisdom and compassion and which easily opens to the peace of Nibbana. Yeah, so this wish to have goodwill even to cockroaches on a bad day. And, you know days like that where just nothing has gone right, and then can we still muster some degree of friendliness? We can also consider our relationship to specific intentions or resolves in our life. So, for example, suppose we have the very beautiful wish, I would like to be more generous. You know, that's actually a wholesome wish. But as soon as we've created that wish in the mind, look at what has happened. So we've created an abstraction, somebody who is more generous than me, or some ideal of generosity, and I've set myself up against it in relationship with it. I would like to be more generous than I am. Okay, so there's somebody who's more generous, there's me, and there's a gap between those. I have X amount of generosity, and Y amount would be better. So in a sense, we've created a relationship. This is fine. We create relationships all the time. But metta is about flavoring all of our relationships with kindness and with goodwill. So the question is, even when we set ourselves up with a wholesome aim, like, I would like to be more generous, can we not use that as, I'm so stingy, I'm so bad, I'll only be better when I improve in my generosity? That's already setting up a strange dynamic there of not liking ourselves very much. So this gets a little bit subtle in terms of practice. You know, can we wish somehow to be wholesome and to even improve and develop without, you know, in a kind way, without making that into a failure of where we are now? So the general state, I would say, of our ordinary mind is that we live in a world of all kinds of distinctions like this. All kinds. In fact, you know, maybe I came up with three. So sometimes the other is something that is external in relation to us. You know, there's us, and then there's our car and our dog and other things. And this is fine. So that usually what happens in that, when we're thinking that way, is that, you know, we're the kind of centerpiece in a universe of changing things, and we move through it. Sometimes others in our mind are objects of awareness. So we have, there's me watching, this is in meditation, there's me watching my body, or there's me aware of my emotions and my thoughts arising and passing, in contrast to, you know, me as the watcher. This is something that meditators learn to do, to see this kind of relationship, to have an observer mind. And that creates then a distinction between the observer and what is being observed. Also a useful kind of distinction. I'm not saying these are wrong. The question is how that relationship is. And then the third kind of abstraction of self-other we do is like this abstraction I talked about. So there's things that we would like to be or should be, or ideals or principles of Buddhism that we want to live up to, and then there's us in relationship to that, somewhat in contrast to that, perhaps. So there's nothing in the Buddhist teachings that says this way of thinking or being is wrong or needs to be changed, or we should live in a non-dual universe. I don't see any of that, but I think these relationships, healing these relationships, is the job of metta, so that we don't have a sense of ill will in our connection between these self-other relationships that we create, if you will. Often, you'll notice, once you start thinking in this way, that often those relationships are marked by a certain degree of ill will. So we create a relationship, and then we may make a problem out of it. So these relationships come with a feeling of inadequacy or wrongness. Might be me who's wrong, might be you who's wrong, might be the world who's wrong. And there's some deficiency, the world needs to needs to stop doing X, or I shouldn't have so much anger. You know, it's endless. But I think when we take this approach of creating all these distinctions and our judgments of them, which ones are good and which ones are bad and right and wrong, I think we're setting ourselves up for some kind of failure. It turns out that we can't actually save the world, and we can't fix everything about ourselves, and we can't make it all right everywhere all the time. So starting from a stance of inadequacy, I think we don't really achieve adequacy. We're modifying a phrase of the Buddha, ill will never ended through ill will, through goodwill alone does it end. Yeah? So the work of metta is to purify our mind of ill will, stopping making a problem out of these relationships that arise. There are a lot of ways that we create problems: aversion, attraction, projection, various things, greed, hatred, delusion. And then we need to kind of heal these, if you will. So I want to talk about some aspects of doing the work of helping to remove ill will from our mind, which is an ongoing, long-term project. The first is just acceptance, you know, starting with acceptance, or even Suchito even says acceptance of otherness, which I kind of like. You know, you're not saying that everything is the same and it's all fine. We accept otherness. We accept, oh, this is different, but it's okay. So the spaciousness to simply accept others as they are. I had an experience at the Insight Retreat Center where I lived for a couple of years. One of the things I did there was I helped create the instructions for retreat managers. So retreat managers are retreatants who come in. I mean, they're like the other retreatants, but they're helping to play a leadership role and serving the other retreatants. And there's a set of instructions about how to be a manager at IRC. And part of my job was to train them when they arrived on the first day. So I was training a manager who hadn't done it before, and there's a lot of written instructions. You know, I had written these instructions which they could then use as a reference sheet once we'd gone into silence. And one of the managers I was training was not happy with the written instructions, and she explained to me that she doesn't learn very well by reading, and these written instructions are very difficult for her, and I really should have pictures, and I should take a lot of photos to go with each of the instructions, and so it could all be visual also, which would be better for her. And I watched my mind kind of dance around with that, because I had a little bit of attachment, because, you know, I wrote those instructions, and so... So I watched my mind kind of dance around, considering whether to be annoyed or threatened by somebody telling me my instructions weren't very good for them. And then something in me just opened, and my mind didn't want to go down that path, basically. And it felt so much better just to say, you know what, she's absolutely right. There are people who don't read instructions, and visual is much better for them, and maybe I'll add a lot of pictures to my instructions, or maybe I won't. But at that moment, I can accept and open and say, okay, this is fine. It's fine the way this is. So this is an act of metta, basically breaking a potential wall that could have formed. You know, a wall could have gone up. I could have said no, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's just like, you're right. You know, I'll try to do something about that. And in the meantime, you know, we'll talk through it today, and you won't need to read it all. Another area of practice that I like is to consider, just to bring to mind the issue of common humanity, is the phrase that's usually used. So ill will accentuates difference. It looks for differences. And goodwill looks for common ground, essentially. So one big area of commonality among humans is our suffering. You know, it's just not that easy to live. It's hard enough just to get the whole life in order, But then in addition, beyond that, our body's breaking down. We're going to go through the old age, illness, death, separation kind of thing. And, you know, Sylvia Boorstein says, life is so difficult. How could we be anything but kind? And I just love that reminder. It's useful even internally, right? On days where things are just frustrating. Really, we're all on this journey. We're all on this same journey of difficulty. However, not to emphasize only the challenge, another area, I think, of common humanity is our desire for something deeper than our surface-level life, our desire. When people call it happiness or peace or ease or freedom, we all have different aims. But there's something in everyone's heart, I feel, I've come to feel that, that is looking for something like that. Now, there are people who are going about it in the most backwards way, and it's not at all going to work, what they're doing. It's not making happiness for them or anyone else. But even they have a sense that they want a more easeful life. They want something. Something beautiful. So we can look for that. We can look for commonalities. Where is there a bonding through our common challenge as humans? And where is there a common bonding through our aspiration and vision and potential as humans? If we go around the world looking for those commonalities, that in itself does a lot to heal the ill will that we would carry otherwise. I have a story to read about, it's actually about Amaravati in England. A Buddhist monastery is an open system, and one gets many visitors, and not all of them are that balanced. A few years ago, a man all called Dennis used to frequent the monastery for some sort of companionship, but always grew loud and aggressive to others in the dorm. He did what he felt was useful work, which was actually counterproductive, and in general made a nuisance of himself until he'd leave, showering everyone with verbal abuse until the next time. So when he turned up one day in the meeting hall, there were a few silent groans. As he started waving his arms around and demanding attention, most people left. One of the monks stood firm and informed Dennis that his behavior was inappropriate for a monastery, which got Dennis even more riled. I looked at this man with his demands, and my mind's lens seemed to widen. Poor guy, I thought, he must annoy so many people. Yet he obviously comes to the monastery for company. So I found myself coming right up to him and calling his name gently, taking him by the arm and walking around the hall with him, talking with him as I did so. I had no expectations. It was just a response, but the effect surprised me. His wildness diminished and his body tension eased. As I commented that he wasn't a bad person, but that his behavior frightened people, he came to a standstill. I put my arm around his shoulder, and he quietly slid down the wall to sit on the floor. In a few moments, he had curled up and was sleeping like a baby. I laid a blanket over him. After a short nap, he woke up calm and coherent, stayed for tea, and then went home. He'd got what he'd been coming for after all these years. I don't think this is just a story about Dennis at the monastery, actually. I see it as metaphorical for what goes on in our own mind, too. You know, do we have voices that show up and demand attention and act obnoxiously? And if so, do we treat them with ill will, telling them they're inappropriate? This is not appropriate for a spiritual person to have anger in my mind. It's no different than Dennis in the monastery, maybe. So have we ever just put our arm around that mind state and gently and lovingly told it that it brings suffering? Maybe it just needs to be seen and not indulged, and then maybe it will finally get what it needs and relax away. So I think another part of acceptance is working to accept and love all aspects of ourselves. And I think this is where metta goes. Even if we try to start externally, we're often carrying some kind of deep self-judgment or self-hatred or self-limitation that's probably the deeper cause of our annoyance with the world. And we're going to have to work on that eventually. Another area to look when we're examining areas where we bring ill will is just this quality that's called conceit in Buddhist practice. And, you know, we have the same word in Western culture, and it tends to have a somewhat narrower meaning than it does in Buddhism. In Buddhism, conceit means any kind of comparative thinking of better than, worse than, and even equal to. Of course, you might wonder what's left after that, but these are all forms of conceit. So, in general, if we're in a position of this comparative mind, it almost never, maybe never, goes anywhere really good. Almost never, I'll say. So, for example, if we're, you know, in a state like this of comparing, then we don't tend to see people who are, say, rich and successful, worldly, successful in a worldly sense, we may not see them with compassion for their suffering because we're too caught up in their status, basically. And also we may not see the beauty and the resilience of those who are, quote-unquote, worse than me. And it may not respect the differences of people who are, quote-unquote, the same as me. It's all about me, right? It's always comparison to me. That's the big issue. Also, I think caught in this conceit of me and the rest of the universe that's different from me, we also tend to lock people into roles. I've seen this in my own mind. You know, my partner, my boss, my teacher. And then we have them in this role, which is somewhat abstracted in our mind. And then we usually tip over into complaining that they're not fulfilling that role. They're not being the way they should be, to be the role of my partner or the role of my teacher, something like that. And so, you know, it's not that, which is really means they're not being the way I want them to be. And so the heart becomes a breeding ground for ill will in situations like that. So there's a lot in metta about resolving difference. There's a difference and there's tension in it, and we resolve that tension. I don't think the difference has to go away completely. There are useful distinctions to make in the world, but can there be no tension in them? I think that's the healing that goes on with metta. And then we have our final connection to the word resolve, which was the prior parami that seems so different from metta. But metta is all about resolve. It's about resolving difference, dissolving difference. The Buddha recognized that this is not easy. I think that's why metta comes late in the sequence, 9th out of 10. So a lot of support has to be in place before we can genuinely extend our goodwill to ourselves and others. I mean, we can start at any level, but for it to really become strong, there's a lot that comes before it. Generosity, you know, the good karma of ethics, being willing to let go, having some patience, having some wisdom, all of these support opening the heart to offer boundless love and safety to the world. So I think metta comes to perfection, these perfections of character. It comes to perfection with boundlessness when it's really completely open, and it's the ripening of our strong effort, our strong resolve that came earlier, ripens and softens into this. It's not all toughness, strong effort. So the Buddha also articulated some blessings that come with the practice of metta. 11 specifically, because we always have to have a list. But I just like to read them because they're kind of interesting. So one sleeps happily, one wakes happily. One does not suffer bad dreams. One is dear to human beings. One is dear to non-human beings. The gods protect one. No fire or poison or weapon can harm one. One's mind quickly gets concentrated. The expression on one's face is serene. One dies unperturbed. And even if one fails to achieve any higher attainments in life, you will at least be born in the Brahma world, which is one of the heavens. So, of course, this is a very classical list, but there are, you know, there are interesting parallels, I think, to even to the modern world. Of course, sleeping, waking happily, and not suffering bad dreams, we can all relate to that one. And being dear to people, you know, there are people who just have a sweetness and an openness about them that's not weak in any way, but it's, people respond to that. Getting concentrated quickly, definitely. You know, one of the biggest barriers to concentration is ill will in and of itself, and then also the restlessness that it generates. So with a mind that's just fine with how things are, it's going to be very easy to get concentrated. No problem to just sit with an object. Serenity, non-perturbedness, these all make sense. Well, maybe I'll just end by adding, since we've talked about how we get from adhitana, resolve, to metta, goodwill, I'll just mention the 10th parami is equanimity, is upekkha. And it's said that, you know, metta has a certain sweetness and warmth and beauty to it that somehow at the very peak of practice cools into the coolness and wisdom of equanimity. There's still something within goodwill that's that can go a little bit farther than that, I guess I would say. And kind of upekkha kind of cools the heat of metta a little bit. But the great thing about these paramis is that you need all of them, and they're all going to get really strong over time as we develop the character of walking the path. So these are my thoughts this morning on metta as a quality of character, as something that we grow to just incorporate into ourselves. It can be done through this formal practice of intention that we are often taught on retreat, and which, you know, many of you may practice. And I just like to open the idea that it saturates us and then becomes integrated, becomes a quality of character, and that's the aim of this metta parami, is to have to move through the world without resistance, in a sense. Are there any comments or questions? We have a little bit more time. Yeah, would you mind using the microphone? Thanks. If you press the green button, it should work.
When we notice that we're comparing, what is a skillful antidote in that moment of awareness?
Mm.
What can be thought, you know, either a better thought or a way to direct the energies?
Mm. So you find yourself thinking something is better than or something worse than, essentially.
Right.
Moving the mind toward common humanity can help, which we talked about a little bit. So, you know, if you're seeing something that you object to and think it shouldn't be happening, not as good as it should be, life is difficult. There's also wisdom in seeing that understanding that whatever's arising at this moment has to arise, essentially. We have choice about how the future unfolds by how we respond to the present moment, but what is coming into the present moment from the past is completely fixed, in a sense. It's already unfolding from karma. So there's Annie Nugent, who's another teacher, has a beautiful phrase about this. She says that we can say, not a wrong arising. You know, there's nothing that can be, something that's coming in from the past has to arise because the conditions for it are there. I'm giving you kind of an abstract notion, but this can fuel phrases like, it's okay, or of course. Gil sometimes uses of course this would show up, or right on time. You know, this has to happen right now. And if it's not to my liking, well, that's to be open to. This helps give the mind an understanding that things kind of have to be as they are at this moment, and it's our response that determines the future. You're still looking a little puzzled. Can you rephrase, or?
Well, that makes sense. I just think I'm kind of feeling into it in a way. It's having kindness to ourselves.
So we can feel our own suffering.
For our own suffering.
Yeah, it's
and
like,
the karma that created that, and it's just, okay, this is here.
Yeah, so if you have a response of disappointment or sadness or anger about something, you know, that too is not a wrong arising. It's something that's coming in from conditions. But at that moment, if we turn toward, we usually say the Four Noble Truths, we turn toward the suffering of that, say, oh, wow, this is really, you know, it's actually painful to be angry at someone before we even say what we're going to say or do what we're going to do. It's hurting us already. And so sometimes just if you're able to open to that, turning toward that feeling and having compassion for that, you know, for the pain that's arising in you through the pain of the judgment, that I have great faith that in the long run, turning toward in that way helps the mind find its way to a more easeful response. Again and again, I've seen this in my own mind, and I can't explain how it works.
I know. I think I'm often in a state right now where I turn inward like that, and it becomes too central.
So okay,
so that's, and I know where it can go. I've had that experience too, but it just the pain is a little sticky.
Okay, so then
right now.
if it's too much to completely open to a certain pain, then the mind can be redirected to something positive or wholesome at that moment. So, for example, you could just turn towards something that you appreciate or are grateful for at that moment, or opening to. Gratitude is one of the best, actually. So there's surely something. Jack Kornfield, when he first became a monk, one of the rules that they have is that they have to, younger monks or more newly ordained monks have to bow to all monks who ordained at a day or any day earlier than them. And so he found, and he was annoyed by this because he was there as this ardent, you know, serious spiritual practitioner. And there were some monks in the monastery who, in his opinion, were old Thai farmers who had just ordained because it was like the food was better there, or, you know, they didn't have anything else to do, so they would do that. And he didn't feel that they were very respectful of the practice, but he had to bow to them because they had ordained earlier than him. And he said that he started just looking for things to appreciate in each person that he had to bow to. And it helped so much, you know, that he would, an old farmer, he would see the creases on his face and say, that face has seen a lot. He's a lot of sun, a lot of life. And he would kind of bow to the wisdom of that. Or he would notice that one of those monks had kindly eyes. And so he would bow in appreciation of his eyes, even though he didn't like much what he was doing. So these kinds of ways of thinking. Does that help? Yeah, okay. Okay, please.
I really resonated with the trap of always trying to improve myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And always falling short. And how do we get out of that loop? Because the resolve and the intention and the sincere,
yeah, it is sincere
effort and desire and need.
Yeah.
That's very real. And yet it can feel like every minute of my life, really, right? Pay attention each moment, eat right, exercise, do my work, show up, sleep like, you know, everything gets there's hardly a moment of rest if that's approached in a painful, you know, in a judgmental way.
Yes, so you've identified that part.
What is that loving kindness twist there? Not to let go, right, of our effort, because that's important. Right effort.
Yeah.
Not to let go of that.
Yeah, well, part of right effort is to end activities that are causing suffering. And if part of what's causing suffering is the fact that we're driving ourselves with a whip, that should be abandoned. That's part of right effort. So effort is very subtle, actually. We use the word effort, and unfortunately in our culture it tends to mean trying and doing something. I think effort includes letting go also. You know, there's and sometimes it takes a little effort to let go. I find sometimes one way when I get a little tight around practice is to literally open the size of my awareness. So, like, you know, mindfulness can be so specific. We can feel our hand picking up the glass, and that's very good practice. But can we just have like a spacious awareness of the whole room and stuff that's arising and passing within the room? Or when we're driving, kind of, it's like the way we're driving, when we have a spacious awareness of the road. That's wise, not to be just like single-mindedly focused on the car in front of you. You're going to miss the pedestrian walking across the street. So literally opening my awareness helps. Also, for about 2 years, I did a practice where all of my off-the-cushion practice and a significant fraction of my on-the-cushion practice was about literally physically relaxing my body, because I needed it. I was really tense when I started practice. And just every moment checking, is my stomach tight? Is my jaw tight? Are my shoulders tight? I mean, not literally every moment. That was an exaggeration. But fairly frequently checking in. And when I would change position, like I would sit down, did I sit with ease or am I a little bit... You know, can I relax into that? Eating, can I not grip the fork, you know? Little things like this. This was a great, great practice for a couple of years. And I still touch into it now and then because I have a tendency to get a little tight in my relationship to the world. So I found that to be really helpful. The literal softening of the body begins to soften the mind and the heart also. So see if any of that helps. Yeah. All right, thank you, everyone.